Artist Denise Green has had a wonderfully international career. She grew up in Brisbane in the 1950s, made her way to art school in Paris, where not long after she found herself confronting the riot police in the famous May 68 uprisings there. She went on to New York, where she studied art under all sorts of luminaries, including Mark Rothko. Later, she met some of the leading lights of French post-structuralist theory. Roland Barthes, Jacques Derrida were influences on her work. It's a remarkable life's journey, and a memoir, An Artist Odyssey, has just been published. And Denise Green joins me in the studio. Hi, Denise.
Hi.
And I should say, listener, if you'd like to follow this online, you can. If you pop along to Denise's website, if you just Google Denise Green, you'll quickly find her website, and there's some images there that you can click on, and you'll see the kind of work she does. So this becomes a sort of illustrated talk, which is just appropriate with a visual artist. Now, Denise, before we go to the glittering times that you spent in Paris and New York, Brisbane, your first studio was under the house.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
Well, of course, Queensland houses have this, it's not really a secret space, but it's kind of an area where, I mean, the houses are lifted on stilts off the ground, so there's this sort of 11 feet of space, and it's enclosed by a lattice sort of fence. So I would find my way there. It was a private space, and I sort of set up a chalkboard and did, you know, my earliest drawings. And I guess that's where my father sort of first noticed my drawing activity. And he took me off to drawing classes when I was about 12, and I won a cup. So that was a very important, you know, sort of omen or something, a way in which...
The cup was.
Yes.
Yeah, you won a prize and someone says to you, hey, you're good at this.
Yes, yes. And I don't think you ever forget it. So I think the fact that my father noticed and then, you know, I then did well and got the cup, that was, those were very, you know, formative. When I look back, you know, that's...
Have you still got the cup?
Oh, yes.
Oh, that's
definitely
good. Now, that sounds sort of dreamy, but actually your dad was a pretty difficult bloke.
Well, he was traumatized by wartime experiences and couldn't support the family. But, you know, that ended up being difficult for me in my teenage years when he pulled me out of school. But before that, I think I knew I was very special to him. And I think that is what I built on, and that was what motivated me, really, to sort of go sort of into the unknown, so to speak, and to... just take risks and, you know, believe that I'd be noticed, believe that I'd be special. I think I knew I would shine. Because
it's a bit of a paradox, because in one sense you're talking about yourself as if you were daddy's girl, but you're also a bit of a rebel, weren't you?
Well, I became a rebel when I got taken out of school so early, and when I was expected to take care of the family. I think because, you know, I was working from the age of 13 on and giving everything I earned to my mother and father. And I knew that if I didn't leave Australia, it led to leaving Australia, but I knew that if I didn't break away and leave home, that I would be taking care of my family for my whole life. That would be my role. So I did become rebellious.
Yeah. So your first escape overseas was to New Zealand, but the next stop was Paris in 1966. I mean, this is epic. You're studying at the École des Beaux-Arts, which is, well, remind us what it is. It's an iconic place to be in 1968.
Yes. I mean, it's the National Art School. It was founded in the early 19th century by Ingres. And, of course, you get the training, the classic training, you know, it had not changed in its curriculum for about 200 years. So you end up learning to draw and you end up learning, you know, how to do very sort of, classical, traditional Western painting, representational painting. But, you know, May and June 68 happened, and I was studying at the Sorbonne during that period too. So I was then very quickly exposed to Marcuse and, you know, the most radical thought.
Right. So this is Herbert Marcuse, whose classic at that time was One Dimensional Man, which had an enormous influence on students right across the West, didn't it?
That's right.
As a sort of critique of industrial society.
Yes, and capitalism.
Yeah. And really, I guess, saying that there had to be a recovery of the human spirit, that somehow capitalism had suppressed the human spirit. There was almost a kind of celebration of the human as really about being creative and sensuous in Marcuse, wasn't there?
Yes.
That was all being switched off by evil industrial capitalism. And so that's part of the kind of idea that's driving students, including yourself, into the streets in Paris in 68.
Yes, yes. Of course, you know, everyone in France was very critical of America. And I had just made a two-week trip there and had seen how vital it was, how the art world was just so energized. I'd participated in be-ins in Central Park. So, you know, it was, you were hearing one thing intellectually and theoretically, but the reality that I'd seen was just quite the opposite.
So you went to New York?
I did.
And what happened?
Well, actually, I met my first husband at the time, Bruce Walmer, who was an intellectual, and he introduced me to his circle, which included John Ashbery, you know, some really major literary figures. And, you know, through the people that he knew, I found out about a graduate program at Hunter College. And it was, as it turned out, the right place to study art at that time. You know, I ended up being in the right school at the right time, studying with Rothko, studying with Motherwell, Robert Morris, and really some major theoretical people like Rosalind Krauss. So I think that that was really a formative experience. I met another painter called Ralph Humphrey, who became a mentor and sort of explained to me, in a sense, how the art world in New York was functioning then. But, you know, along with Bruce and with Ralph, I ended up being in major museum shows such as the Whitney and the Guggenheim at a very early stage in my career.
Now, the ideas that you encountered and explored there at Hunter College, I take it, are the core ideas with which you've been in conversation pretty much ever since.
Yes, I mean, there were two very strong directions, I guess you'd say. The conceptual artist represented by Robert Morris, who said painting was dead, and then others such as Rothko and Ralph Humphrey and Motherwell, who argued that, well, Rothko in particular argued that his generation had taken painting as far as it could go and that there'd be a return to some kind of image in painting. And that I found very inspiring.
It seems extraordinary now, especially to the general listener, that there could be a moment in painting when to paint things that look like things was considered sort of reactionary, that beyond painting things there was a notion of painting as a more elementary, more truthful almost activity.
Well, the fact is, when I was included in the Whitney show, it was the first exhibition of painting that had a figurative reference in 30 years. Prior to that, it was pretty much abstract expressionism and you know, post-surrealist sort of painting.
Yeah.
So there was a shift, a major shift.
If we look at some of the works that you've got on your website, if we just click on number one, for example. Oh, no, hang on. We have to go to paintings at the top of the page. So we're just on Denise Green's website, which is denisegreen.net. If you Google Denise Green, you'll find it. If we look at painting number three, say, which is two windows in a square, so just very simple windows, like windows in a storybook or a catalogue almost of windows, but it's the background that's kind of interesting too, because you don't just create a sort of modernist block of colour onto which you put an icon. There's something very sensuous about the painting world in which you've situated your icon, isn't there?
Yes. I guess what you don't pick up from the illustration or the scanned image is that the white area is really sort of thinned paint. So it's a monochromatic painting where the image is created in a sense by thinning, diluting the paint, but just making it, you know, one colour. So it's got a conceptual basis in that way. It's a little bit like a Rothko painting, which is sort of fields of colour, except that within that I've introduced an image without actually drawing it, without picturing it through illusionism.
No, it's like an icon. Mm-hmm. It's like a picture that stands for chair rather than this is Gauguin's chair.
Right.
That's an important difference, isn't it?
Yes, 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 it is. It's a manifestation of For me, it's a manifestation of a state of mind. I sort of thought when I was painting the image of a window that I wanted to find an image or a shape that would convey an idea about openness. So I was not only sort of looking for an object, but I was looking for a feeling or a state of mind associated with openness. So that in all of the work that I did during that period, it was in a sense, taking a vessel shape and the way that I painted it, I thought of the vessel shape as representing, say, something closed, a closed object. And if I had a fan shape, it would represent an object that was open. Mm. So it would be the idea of having two opposite states of mind, openness and closedness.
This is Books and Arts Daily, and I'm talking to Denise Green about her very seductive artworks. I say seductive, but not initially seductive. I mean, that they're the sort of thing with respect that a person could just walk past because, okay, you've drawn a fan and then another one, you've drawn lots of fans, and then you've drawn just the outline of a vase. A person could say, okay, there's not much to that. It's the dwelling with the work that reveals that there's something more to it. I mean, you know, I'm not trying to be rude. I'm actually trying to celebrate if you stay with the work.
Yes, no, I see what you're saying. And I think that with this kind of work that I do, which to some people it could look quite abstract, but I think that what, if you do stay with the work, then it grabs you somehow. And in being grabbed, you spend time with it and you then connect with the emotional power of the work. I guess I could say that I have a vocabulary that sort of conveys an imaginative reality, such as the fans, the vessels, the house shape, etc. And then, in working with those shapes, they become invested with a certain kind of emotional power. Mm. And that's a whole different thing. But that's what grabs your attention, and that's what makes it possible that you could see it and see it as a rather minimal painting, but if it grabbed you, you'd stay with it and try to figure out what the mystery is or what that power is.
I'd love to have time to talk to you about your idea of metonymy, which is an important idea for you, but we're just going to run out of time here. Let's talk about insights that you have as now an experienced artist on building a career, because you've been very successful in how you've built a career. What is it that the young artist faces today in getting noticed, getting counted?
Well, I think given how globalized the art world has become, I think it entails a lot of travel. I think it entails being entrepreneurial. It means, you have to be out there. I know the internet is there and you can establish contacts through that. You can see what's going on. You can be totally informed through that. But you do have to reach out and have face-to-face meetings. That really does mean moving away from the safety of the studio.
You can't be a hermit and hope the world will discover you online.
No. But I found, too, that writing about art was crucial because at a certain point I did want to show in Europe as well as New York and Australia. And I found that curators, especially in Europe, who are scholars, really wanted to know what your ideas were. So I began publishing as a way of, having a means or an agenda or a shared sort of dialogue with people who wanted to see what I did. Yeah. And wanted to get involved with it. If they knew I'd published something and they read it, and if they were drawn to the ideas that I was working with, that was a whole other level of communicating and maintaining and cultivating a relationship. So the books that I've written, the two books, as well as the articles that I publish, are a very important part of how I've shaped my career.
Is there anything, though, frustrating about the idea that in order to understand or fully appreciate the work, the viewer needs also to understand what you've got to say about the work? Or do you think that's just the way art is, that the subjectivity of the painter needs to be part of the total experience of understanding his or her work?
Well, things have changed. There was a time in the 50s and 60s with Clement Greenberg who sort of believed that work, that paintings and artwork should speak for themselves. But I think that it's all very well and good. I mean, certain kind of abstract formalist painting did speak for itself, but in fact, Greenberg was speaking for it and arguing. Yeah. and showing, what was there. I teach, in the graduate program at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, the students have to write a thesis. They have to articulate their ideas. More and more, if you're meeting galleries, critics, curators, you share your ideas. You have to really, I think, help people enter your world. And, you know, it's not so easy to write about art, actually, but I do think that it coaxes people to be more involved.
Denise Green, it's been lovely to talk to you. Thank you for coming by and having a chat here in the Books and Arts Daily Studio.
Thank you, Michael.
Denise Green, it's really lovely to look at her website and explore it. As I say, if you Google Denise Green, you'll find it there. And her book is called Denise Green, It's an Artist Odyssey. It's a book about her work. She's written some of the chapters and other chapters have been written by other people. And it's a very interesting reflection on a career. This is Books and Arts Daily here on RN.